The Lead Icon Podcast.
Shape the future. Lead with purpose. Go iconic.
Today, I had the privilege of interviewing Joe Hernandez, who is the CEO of Precision Electronic Technologies, a Melbourne-based manufacturing company that specializes in electronic services. Joe has been at the helm of this business for 25 years and has grown it from strength to strength. Now, Joe also talked to me about manufacturing and the need for Australia to invest more into its manufacturing capabilities so that we can improve our sovereignty. We also discussed what it takes to be a great leader. I hope you enjoy our very compelling conversation. Welcome, Joe. It's lovely to meet you.
Thank you, Deanna. I'm quite pleased to be here, actually.
Joe, it's been a long time coming, us, you know, meeting. We've been discussing this interview for quite a bit of time, and particularly with respect to this interview series, which is all about predictions for business for 2025 and beyond. And your particular sector, which is electronics and manufacturing, was highly interesting to me and my team, because it underpins everything we have, you know, from our mobile devices, our computers, to medical devices. And you've been in this business now for quite a number of years, and I know
a long time ago,
and you recently I remember reading that you've won three awards in the White Horse Business Awards.
Correct. Yes, we did. Business Excellence Awards. And that follows on from us having won a couple of years ago an Australia-wide award, a Gold Award with Business Excellence Australia. So.
Well, congratulations. I think, you know, the industry that you're in, and particularly the company that you've grown, you know, our listeners will be very fascinated to know what you've gone through to get to where you are today, and what specific problems manufacturing has, you know, has experienced, and what challenges are, I guess, still, you know, we're encountering. So, but before we get to that, could you give us a brief overview of what made you open or start Precision Electronics? Because you're the CEO and founder of Precision Electronics, and I remember we spoke about this, that you actually purchased, you bought into the business.
Yes, that's correct, yes. Originally, I'm not even sure where the starting point, ground zero, is in terms of interest for electronics, but it's probably middle or high school years, and I remember going to an open day at Flinders University in Adelaide, and they had this, they were launching this new mainframe computer in this big room, I can't remember, and that's probably where my interest in electronics started. You know, back then, such a big room, such a big computer, and it probably had nowhere near the capacity of our present smartphones, but that's the beginning. Then I moved to Sydney with my parents. My cousin had started a printed circuit board manufacturing company, and printed circuit boards, I'll refer to them as PCBs, are the base on which electronics is, you know, all the electronic components are connected. Anyway, he started a business, very early days of PCBs, kind of technology wasn't that brilliant, but it was a start. I worked at his facility after high school, on different days. And then by the time I finished high school, I went to work for him full time. And I learned everything there was to learn about making PCBs. And there's a lot of skills involved, a lot of technology, which has increased over the years. But that's where my love for PCBs and electronics really flourished. Ultimately, I took on a manager's role, and then set up a factory in Melbourne, a PCB manufacturing company, went back to Sydney, learned about PCB designing, and then back to set up another factory in Sydney. Ultimately, I did study electronics at night school during all of that. And then I was doing an MBA at Macquarie Uni, which I never got to finish because this business came on the market in an unusual way, and I bought into it in a long time ago, 91, where a venture finance company and a working partner, my job was operations, this was marketing, and by 2000, I bought both partners out. But I've been CEO ever since, and we had a real challenging 15 years thereabouts because PCBs were on the way out, going to China. You know, we went from 100 employees with two manufacturing plants down to about 30 employees just barely survived, to be honest. But that's a history. And now we don't make bare PCBs anymore, but we do assemble them. So they're called PCBAs, printed circuit board assemblies. And that's our primary product now, as well as product, full product assembly. We're finally in a growth phase again.
In terms of your growth phase now, are you finding that there's a, you know, with the Internet of Things and other technologies that have come into existence, are you finding you're pivoting into a different direction now? Or, you know, is your technology changing? How are you, you know, adapting with the times?
Well, technology, it has changed as long as I've been involved in this industry, continues to change. That's why ultimately you've got to make enough profit, not just to stay in business, but to continually reinvest in technology, because components are getting smaller, denser. Circuit boards are more complicated. You know, there's components on both sides of circuit boards now, and it's they can be very complicated things. You know, like a smartphone. I'm just looking at my smartphone over there. That's about as complicated as it gets, almost. But so it's an evolving line all the time, and you do need to pivot.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of the current landscape, manufacturing landscape in Australia, how would you describe the manufacturing industry in Australia? I know that's a very broad sector because
it is.
You've got different areas, but
yes.
how would you describe our current situation?
Well, clearly manufacturing as a whole sort of lost its appeal, you know, and its appetite for investments. Back, you know, in the last 20-odd years, I look back at the history, not the history, but figures to do with manufacturing. Back in the 60s, 50% of the GDP was manufacturing. And obviously that's at the time where the government was bringing in families from, you know, all over Europe to try and fill the working requirements of this a growing industry. I was a beneficiary of that. My parents immigrated to Australia as a result of that. But we were, you know, the manufacturers dropped down to from 25% in the 60s, mid 60s, sorry, 50% in the mid 60s, down to 25% in the early. Now let me think about this. Yeah, no, it halved. It halved by the early 2000s, and now we're down to about 5%. So 5% of GDP is a small number in reality, but it's still an important part of the Australian landscape. And I think we've discovered as a result of COVID, the over-reliance on goods being manufactured overseas is a problem. Mm-hmm. In terms of sovereign rights to this country, defence and so on, there's definitely a push now to onshore, reshore, different terms, but same meaning. And we've benefited that since COVID. I know of two major customers of ours now that brought work back to Australia, and we're still benefiting from that now. But I do sense that the reasons why work was being reshored is waning now, and people are starting to look at the bottom line price again, having quickly forgotten about what can happen during a problem time, in, you know, with supply chain interruptions and not being able to travel, as was the fact then, and freight issues and so on. But then the reshoring efforts seem to have stalled now, and I think there's a pull now to take it back offshore. by some in some quarters anyway.
So, what are some of the challenges in rebuilding our manufacturing so that we are more self-sufficient? I was at a conference recently, and Peter Costello was one of the guest speakers, and he said that during the Howard Costello, I guess, government, what they did, they privatized, many, and it actually started with the Hawke Keating government, the liberalization
Yes.
of the markets and manufacturing. So a lot of things started, a lot of industries, a lot of, started to get privatized. And one of the things that he said was, at the time it was a good idea, but looking back now, they realize that it actually has meant that Australia isn't as competitive as it could have been. So, what are the current challenges in attempting to rebuild a strong manufacturing sector?
In some cases, like for us, PCB manufacturing is gone. There used to be 24 PCB manufacturers in Australia. That's gone now. This might be one or two very small ones. To bring that back, it's millions of dollars worth of investment by somebody. So it's the rebuilding of some of the skill sets that have now been lost to this country. Are going to be It's going to be difficult from where I stand. Not to say it can't happen, but it'll take some drive and some encouragement by governments to see that through. So that's probably my take on it. But clearly, there's still opportunities in.
So I guess in terms of the government policies, because we've just touched on that, what are you seeing? Are you seeing any policy change with respects to the current government? Are they attempting to bring back manufacturing in a or to
In a
invest?
meaningful
What are
way.
you seeing?
I'll probably answer that shortly. Just going back to previous governments, you're talking about Peter Costello. Certainly, I mean, we have he visited us when he was treasurer at one time, and but there's been probably a lack of, I wouldn't call it an understanding, but the thing we have with such short government cycles is that your one government drives a certain direction and another government then changes direction, so we don't have continuity. I think that's a disadvantage that we've had in this country in terms of industry support and understanding. I reckon one of the biggest mistake that was made, it goes back as far as the 80s, when we had a chance to get Intel to set up a semiconductor plant in Australia, but that would have required a lot of government assistance and drive. Intel, Australia's got natural advantages with raw materials, silicon, and so on, and a highly educated workforce by general standards, and stable political environment. But at that stage, it was between us and Ireland, and we kind of missed out. There wasn't any government support. Taxes were higher here than Ireland, and all these different things. And at the end of the day, we missed out on that opportunity. But had we taken that opportunity, had the government taken that opportunity, the landscape in Australia for electronics manufacturing would be like so different today. I think we'd be talking probably tenfold the size that we'd be today had we made that investment back then. So I say, and I think at that time it was probably a Liberal government. It doesn't matter what flavour it is, it's having that longer term view, and kind of having both political parties agreeing and staying the course. In terms of right now, what's happening right here and now, there's a few things that have happened that are probably increasing cost to manufacturing, power pricing being one of them, energy pricing. I think we're trying to change to renewables too fast, increasing the cost. I'm not sure what the future looks like in terms of where this will land, but manufacturing requires power. So that's only going to drive prices up, and some manufacturing companies will probably be in trouble in a few years' time if that doesn't stop. IR changes recent times, I think that's going to increase costs on the labour side of things. And I was thinking at the time when the current government was making these changes to IR, it's like, well, all the gains that we've had with reshoring could be, short-lived with these changes and the loss of flexibility and the increase of cost. So too often there isn't that broader
Yeah.
view by governments.
So again, if we go back to the, I guess the, governments, because you've got two parts to the pie here. You've got, or maybe three parts. You've got government, you've got the business, and then you've got investment.
Yes.
So, we're constantly saying, oh, the government needs to be doing something. And clearly the government has a lot on their plate, and they're juggling many, many conflicts and interests.
Yes.
So, what could business and private investment do to, I guess, overcome that type of obstacle? Is that something that has not been pursued enough?
Quite possibly. I know that even though when I bought into this business event, we were involved, or venture finance company got involved with us, and that's a Optus get on the way. But I do hear from, I see so many great ideas, so many new products developed in this country, being, especially being a contract electronic manufacturer. You see all these beautifully designed ideas and so on, but a lot of them don't get off the ground because of lack of investment or lack of appetite by longer term investors with a particular product. So at the same time, I see some products that we have one customer now that in the last few years they've experienced enormous growth. So we see both ends of the spectrum in terms of success and not lack of success. But usually lack of success is not so much a poorly designed or poor idea, it's lack of money.
And I guess it's also lack of time, because that would require a lot of networking on your part and other, I guess, industry leaders to be able to mobilize. So it's something to consider. So in terms of I guess the future of manufacturing in Australia, if we look at 5, 10, 15 years, what types of innovations are we really looking at? Like, because we see a lot of sci-fi stuff, because everything, AI is the flavor of the month. And although it's helping in a lot of ways,
It is.
what do you think is a realistic, in terms of innovation?
Oh, well, clearly digital transformation has to be part of the equation. There's no, I don't think there's much of a future without, because the rest of the world is moving and moving fast. I just come back from a trip to China and visited a couple of our partners there, and it's just amazing. The amount of digital transformation that's taking place, and you'd be thinking, well, they've got cheaper labor, access to cheaper labor than we do. Maybe they don't need all this digital transformation and AI. Well, they're actually moving very fast. From an Australian point of view, we absolutely need to embrace digital transformation with AI, obviously. Otherwise, I think the future will be bleak. It's things move on all the time. Things are changing, and if you can't keep up with it, it's trouble in the future. And digital transformation is one of these things. Certainly, we've had to embrace it. So that's for starters. In terms of manufacturing for the future, advanced manufacturing, we have to embrace automation. We have to embrace. There is a future around defence. Certainly, the government now is focused a lot more on sovereignty risk, with what happened a few years back. So now there is a future for defence-related manufacturing. So there are probably a couple of areas that the future is bright.
That's so when you talk about digital transformation, you expand on that? I know you've said automation and AI, but what specifically are we talking about?
Well, it's having as much data available to you from your current processes that allows you to make faster decisions, better decisions, and bigger improvements. And that's where the transformation bit comes. I've always used to think, if you don't change, well, if you stay still, you're going backwards because the rest of the world's changing, and there was a certain pace of change. But now with AI and digital transformation, the pace of change is now exponential. It's not what happens in over a few years, it's what happens over a few months now almost.
And weeks
They're
in
weeks.
some cases,
That's
especially
right.
like
That's right. Exactly. Yes.
so touching on this building competitive advantage,
Yes.
I know we're in a sort of gridlock with manufacturing in Australia, but if you were Prime Minister,
Yes.
what would you change?
What would I change? I think I'd be certainly looking at putting some sort of working committee around manufacturing and working out the problems that manufacturing industries is currently facing, and being as encouraging as possible. I'm not suggesting throwing dollars at it because they can be problematic, but certainly looking at regulations, looking at well, energy, definitely energy is a big problem and becoming a bigger problem. Even the skilling up of workforce, clearly the workforce needs to change that with digital transformation. They have to be more comfortable with handling data and information. So I'd be certainly looking at what's possible by working with industry. Not telling industry what to do, but working with industry.
And having industry deciding and working together through this, because what we're seeing at the moment is you're seeing bureaucracy making decisions.
Yes.
And I'm not
Yes.
saying that you can't have like you shouldn't have a bureaucracy. I'm just
No,
saying
yeah.
that it needs to be balanced. That's what
Yeah,
you're
yeah. Yeah, you do. And then, make life simpler, not more difficult through bureaucracy, through regulations. Obviously, in the last few years, we've heard of so many companies who've somehow incorrectly paid their staff. And I'm thinking, well, we've got an HR department. Hopefully, we're doing everything right. I'm pretty sure we are. But at the same time, there's that many awards and that many, rules and regulations. You could skip one or two, and next thing you're going to be called a thief. Kind of scenario, even though it wasn't intentional. So I think we need to make life simpler. If you're a newbie in getting involved in manufacturing, there's so much you have to navigate right from the start.
So in terms of the digital transformation, we covered it in manufacturing. However, there's a lot of, I guess, talk on the streets that not enough, SMEs or the uptake of digital transformation with SMEs is slow, or very, patchy. Why do you think that? Why do you think there's a reluctance?
I think, firstly, I don't think people understand what digital transformation is, nor do they. Well, if you don't understand it, you can't obviously see the immediate benefits that you would get. But more than that, I think when it comes to SMEs, I was thinking about this question. When it comes to SMEs, they're usually time poor. You don't have a lot of extra staff that you can throw at a problem. That's an issue in itself. Lack of internal funding as well, because you have to, digital transformation will cost you before you get the benefits. and you'll need to find time to start the journey of transformation, work out, you know, the important one or two projects, because you can't take too much on either, because there's that many things that you could work on in terms of digital transformation. And the next thing you know, it becomes a huge mountain to climb. So we've taken on, well, I've set up a steering committee. We meet regularly, only earlier this year, and we looked at various projects that we might want to begin with. You know, for this year, we've already got two underway, another two that we're looking at. And then you've got to make sure you've got the resources, both from a human perspective as well as from a financial perspective, to make those changes. You're going to know what you want at the end of the day in terms of improvements and return on investment. You're going to understand all this, but it's a must now, certainly from a manufacturing point of view. I again, coming back to my recent China trip, I was looking at one organization that had that much information on screens everywhere, just blowing in from various machines and various setups and the organization as a whole. And you know, it's changing, the information's changing in real time. And I'm like, whoa. And they make decisions according to all of this. So if something's starting to go haywire somewhere, they can catch it real early. So that's kind of what I'm hoping we'll see. But it's a 4 to 5 year journey. Again, talking to that particular organization, they've been going for 3 years on digital transformation. So it's a long journey. You won't get instant results, but it's a journey that must be started.
There's a annual survey that comes out that measures, different company competitiveness.
Yes.
And it comes out of Switzerland, and they measure things such as, entrepreneurship, productivity,
Yeah.
and while Australia does some really good things,
Yes.
we fall short on entrepreneurship and also, on our competitiveness.
Yeah, on productivity, definitely we're lagging behind now.
Yes, exactly. And so, just listening to you, you went, you traveled to China to meet with, because you've got business interests there.
Yeah.
What do the Chinese do that we could, I guess, learn from?
Well, they probably look at a bit like Japan, they look longer term, where we investors here in Australia look short term. Even in terms of the digital transformation journey, you need to look long term, not like short term. For short term, you're going to spend some money, but long term, you'll get some really good outcomes. I think that's one of the things. You know, when I first went to China, when we were starting to shut down PCB manufacturing because there was a shift to China, obviously, I visited Chinese manufacturers looking at setups and partnership arrangements, and they were just throwing people at the job. They had good equipment from the start, but they were throwing people at the job. Now, back in Australia, we even had loaders to load PCBs into a conveyorized line and a stacker at the other end, rather than have people, because it was already expensive. You know, straight over there, they just had people hand loading, people collecting at the other end, and so on. But that's 20, 25 years ago. Now there's a lot of automation, even though they probably don't need it by global terms, because they're still a cheap labor source. But they've continuously evolved. They've not rested.
So we've got our work cut out for us, Joe. Now, if we turn now to standards and expectations,
Yeah.
I remember when we first, we talked over the phone in discussing, this particular interview, and we talked about, we used the word excellence,
Yes.
and you said that was very important to you.
Yeah.
Could you share what you mean by that? What does that involve, having that quality of excellence?
Yeah. Well, you know, if you're going to be a manufacturer, you've got to have some standards that allow you to be consistent in your outputs and in your quality and so on. Obviously, quality management systems are one of those, ISO 9001. And I remember back in, I think it was in the 90s, when Senator Button had this industry plan, and it was all around Having companies with quality system management systems in place and also total quality management. And it did make a difference, I think, at the time. Within 10 years, there was definitely improvements. So therefore, that's an absolute minimum now because things have moved on. For us, we started embracing the Australian Business Excellence Framework, ABEF framework. There's non-business excellence principles within that. And 12 years ago, we just started the journey of starting to work towards those principles or implementing those principles. And they're a must. But now, we were a struggling business 12 years ago. Now we're a thriving business. So it works. Business excellence works. I've just listed a couple of those principles as an example. Having clear direction and mutually agreed plans within the organization is a business excellence principle. Understanding what customers and other stakeholders value is a business excellence principle. And just on that one alone, you think, stakeholders, obviously we've got customers, we've got staff. That's where it starts. Maybe you bring in suppliers. But we ended up doing working through our stakeholders. We ended up with 44 stakeholders as we were working through this principle. As an example, the families of our staff, they're a stakeholder different to our staff. The First Nations people also are a stakeholder. And so all of a sudden, things improve on so many fronts. Engaged people, engaged staff, that's an absolute must, but you've got to be intentional about it. So if I could encourage anyone who's listening to this podcast, have a look at this business excellence principles within the Australian Business Excellence Framework, and start to work on some of those to improve your business.
That's a really, good point that you raise, and it's wonderful that you use principles as a guide,
Yes.
like virtues that
Yeah.
guide your business so that it's not only adapting, but I guess that harmony that you're trying to
Yeah.
create, because
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
very hard to grow and I guess maintain a business. Now, what about leadership? So you look at there are so many wonderful businesses, in Australia, and they do create a lot of value for people. What is it? There's two parts to this. What do you do personally to invest in yourself to be a better leader? Because there's a difference between leading and being a boss, because you've got to sometimes pull out the boss card, and leading is a much more nuanced
Yes, it is.
and challenging, long-term, continuously changing sort of approach to managing and leading people. And then the second part is what do you think that, so what are your investments in yourself as a leader? And do you see other leaders investing in themselves?
Yes, the answer to that question is yes and no. In terms of here, I could say without a shadow of a doubt, each year I continue to evolve. But that's to me, that's part of excellence. But also, it's just part of what should happen. So, in terms of investing in myself, I do a minimum of 40 hours of professional development a year. But this year I'm going to be closer to about 80 hours. And I insist on all members of our leadership group to invest anything depending on their roles and where they're at between 20 and 40 hours. Unless it's their last year in leadership and they're intending to retire next year, then I'll set it at zero. Other than that, you have to continuously evolve in yourself because things do change, but there's always something to learn. I know every time I go to a conference or a webinar, you come back with two, three ideas. Without failure, two, three ideas that you can bring change to your organisation with. And so, yeah, that's from a leadership point of view. It requires continuous investment and a willingness to change. I even allow my leadership group to talk to me. At the beginning of each year, when we look at setting direction for the next year's, anything that they would have done differently if they were in my role. Sometimes it can be challenging to hear that, but it's important to hear it.
Do you find with the change in the way, or the uncertainty that's occurring, I guess not just domestically but in the world, what do you think are the top skills, like the top four skills that leaders need now to really like either introduce or refine?
This will be fine. Engaging your staff, for one of them, engaging your team, knowing what's required to engage your team, and there's different requirements for different people. But you need to know how to engage your team. Certainly, once you get to CEO level, you need a team around you, and you need to understand what your weaknesses are, and allow other people's strengths to cover your weaknesses and work together as a team. So, teamwork, collaboration, very important. Culture, managing culture, because ultimately leaders determine the culture. And I'm a big one on culture. Culture is everything in the organisation.
And you've got a you've systemized your approach to culture, haven't you? You want to sort of elaborate on what that involves.
Well, as I mentioned, culture is everything. The success of the organization will rise or fall on the culture. I know Peter Drucker, famous management expert, has said that culture eats strategy for breakfast. He wasn't saying don't strategize, but he was saying that you can have the best strategy, but if you don't have the culture to see it through, it's going to be a waste. And I know recently there was a headline, and I won't say which organisation, but an organisation that's gone through a few CEOs, a few public companies have gone through a few CEOs in recent times, and the headline was whatever the company was, it's CEOs for breakfast. Ultimately, yes. And we see what bad culture will do. Equally, I've seen what good culture it does as well. So yeah, what we do is each year we've taken on a different ingredient or element of culture that we want to nurture. As an example, a few years back, I wanted us to develop appreciation within our culture. So we talked about that at our annual planning workshop, and then we made a point throughout the year of reminding ourselves as leaders, we want appreciation become part of our culture. So what have you done in the last few weeks, Leader X, to see that, to see improvements on that front? And by the end of the year, definitely I could say safely that appreciation had become part of our culture. But this year I've taken on a different approach. We've because culture changes, it changes with automatically. No, it just changes. It changes with intent or accidentally, our choice. So, as leaders, we should want it changed for it to change with intent. So, the way we've approached it this year with our people and culture manager is I've been meeting with her and the leadership group as a whole, and we've decided to list out what a high performance positive culture would look like. What would the ingredients be? We limited ourselves to 20 ingredients, or elements, probably a better term, of what that culture would look like. Obviously, appreciation is one of them. Accountability is another. There's a whole a list that we've come up with, and we surveyed our team, the whole team, in terms of those 20 elements, how they would rate 1 to 10. Those ingredients look like. Within precision. I haven't seen the results. They are available, but I've told our people and the culture manager to hang on to it. During the annual planning workshop in January, we'll have a look at how those 20 elements are rated by our team. And then we'll have a look at our weak points, and then we'll set some direction and some some action points within each of those points to see what we need to do to increase the score of those elements during 2025. So yeah, culture changes all the time. It's best to be aware and then change it with intent.
It definitely is something that is popping up all the time now. Like, we had problems in large organizations like Qantas. Even Fortescue last week was apparently they had a bit of a they called it the red bath, the red cafe. And apparently, yeah, they've put in line a few of the decisions that were made because a particular mine, its budget blew out, and they attributed not just to culture but also to decision making and cost cutting. So while culture is really important, what do you think in terms of you can talk about culture and you can have assets in place and you can have your culture ambassadors in place. But when it comes to the important decisions that drive costs, that drive revenue, that drive innovation, that drive the right decisions, how do you manage that in your business?
Well, I certainly like to ensure that people are empowered to make decisions, but then there are different levels of decisions. Some decisions ultimately have to be made by the board, as an example, others by the leadership group. Others by individual members of the leadership group, and ultimately by their team. And when it comes to day-to-day decisions on the shop floor, if something's not going well, I'd like to think that somebody's going to make the decision to stop the line and see what's happening, rather than continue making a problem. So it's about having that safety zone, giving people that safety zone to make decisions and feel comfortable making decisions. And then, even if a wrong decision is made, it's not about giving that person a hard time. It's just working through how that decision was made, and ensuring that in future they look at things maybe differently. But I would never stop or remove power from individuals to make decisions at the level at which they're working.
That's important because
Mm.
a lot of in the work that we do, we often get feedback that people don't feel heard,
Yes.
that they don't feel heard and they don't feel like their ideas are actually not even ideas, but their I guess their recommendations are not
Yeah.
taken on. So
That's right.
because everything is so
Yeah.
fast. So
No, during just made me think of one thing, but during my learnings working for somebody a long time ago, but I remember one particular boss I had, a CEO. He was a micromanager, so keen in making decisions, but ultimately I found myself in a position where I stopped making decisions. So I've experienced that firsthand. I don't want my team to feel the same way, stop making decisions because Joe will make that decision. No, I try again. That's through learnings, as we work ourselves through management.
So, going back to small business now, small medium-sized business, because we're not talking about, the big end of town. We're talking about where the bulk of businesses sit. What do you think, we could do as a group to have our voice heard? Because there's a lot of great brains
Oh, yeah.
across various sectors.
Yes.
What do you think we should do?
I was thinking about that because obviously I knew that question was coming, but there's 2.6 million SMEs in Australia. When I thought I'd research that information, and that amazed me. It's 2.6 million SMEs. You'd be thinking that's a huge voice, but unfortunately, SMEs generally, in a lot of cases, run their businesses alone, and probably feel they don't have a voice, and they because the only way to have a voice is for us all to get together, and the only way that could happen is through industry associations, perhaps the government could encourage it. But SMEs generally don't have the time to network either, so that's a problem in and of itself. And certainly your local MPs wouldn't have time to visit all their SMEs in their electorate to try and get a feel for what's happening in the SME world. But having a voice could make a huge difference. And I didn't come to a conclusion on that question you asked me early as to what could be done. But SMEs having a voice would be super important.
Well, that's why we're having this conversation, Joe, because from this, you know, the different industry experts that we're interviewing, we'll compile a white paper out of it, and then we can, you know, use that as a form of, you know, starting a conversation, and let's see where that takes us.
Yeah, well, that would be an awesome outcome.
Yeah, because we have a lot more power in our hands. Where we can actually be an asset to, you know, the government.
Yes.
Rather than, you know, what are you doing? What are you doing? It's like, here's the solution. Here's what we're doing.
I wonder what those 2.6 million SMEs in terms of the percentage of people employed, but it would be a significant amount.
That's right. That's right. And and to your point, many are like a one-person band.
Yes.
But then there are like, there's hundreds of thousands that employ, you know, five and above employees, you know, up to whatever it is that. I think once you hit to 199, then you're a big company.
Yeah.
Which is, I think that those metrics also a little bit.
Yeah, and that would depend on that. You know, there'd be other countries like in America, it would be probably 1,000 plus before you're a large company. But
that's right. Yeah. That's right. That's what I'm thinking too.
Yes.
So. To finish it off and bring it all together, Joe, what's 3 to 4 predictions for like next year and beyond that you've got? And you don't have to limit it just to manufacturing; it can be just for business, overall business. Yeah. What are your predictions?
Well, it's three. Well, I came up with 3 positive predictions for the industry for manufacturing, and then 3 negative predictions because you never know which way it'll fall. But the 3 positive ones, it'd be an increased investment in advanced manufacturing. And it's already happening now, you know, in terms of like robotics and aviation and defense and so on. So that's already underway, in my opinion. Onshoring of critical industries with defense, definitely it's happening. So sovereignty issues, we continue to see that happen. And then a third one would be expansion of high value products, and kind of niche, high volume, high value products that are not high, super high volume. You know, I remember there was a study done maybe 20 years ago, which it would happen again in our industry, but the average production run was 80 to 90. And that's more small numbers. So we're not a high volume, we'd probably never be a high volume manufacturing country. The good thing about that is that we set up, and certainly I've set up our manufacturing base on small to medium volumes. We can never make a phone here in, you know, hundreds of millions or plus numbers. That would take a total different investment route. So yeah, expansion of high value products, I think will continue, will be a positive prediction. On the negative side, there could be skill shortages and workforce challenges, especially as we go down the digital transformation route. Be a lot more information to work through, and therefore we need people to understand data more than now. One that really worries me is the rising energy costs and potential power shortages into the future. But we can't continue to have rising energy costs to the level that we're experiencing now. Because that's, for some industries, that's there's a fair percentage of their cost structure is energy. Certainly when I used to make PCBs, our energy bills back then were huge. So if we're still making PCBs now, I can't imagine what it'll look like.
Interesting, Joe, because I read, widely, and for example, Google and I believe Amazon too, they're investing in nuclear power plants to be able to fuel their data centers. So I'm assuming that, it won't take long before Australia goes down that path also.
Well, I'm certainly hoping so in some ways. I mean, it's a good thing to go down the renewable route. I get that. But at the same time, there has to be a baseload provided by some other source to keep constant power. When I first go into China, again, I remember 25 years ago, you go, you walk into a factory and it's shut down. The offices are there, but today we don't have power. It's not the case now. Obviously, they've been building power stations, that weekly, but so they don't have that problem. But I'm thinking as I'm getting towards the back end of my career, I'm thinking, I wonder if I'll see that in Australia. Sorry, we don't have power today, but that would be a disaster if it got that far. I think our governments have been gambling a fair bit on purely on renewables, and if that gamble doesn't pay off, it'll be a disaster for manufacturing.
And it's also political, the decisions. I recall I was speaking to he's a lawyer who works in government, and I was asking him why do we not have a fast train, like a high speed train network? And I thought it was short term thinking, and he said to me, no, he goes, it's because the logistics industry and the airline industries have basically that strong lobby groups that prevent that from happening, because we're not a 100 million population, we're a 20, 27 million population, and so it's competition, which is actually quite sad because we're missing out
On the benefits of that.
on benefits, and it would actually benefit them long term too,
I mean,
but.
can you imagine if we had a fast train between Sydney and Melbourne, city centre in 3 hours? Well, that'd be going to the airport any time, and an hour or two beforehand. But anyway, there's been many governments for about 30 years who've not been able to make that decision. I was actually talking to a French company who make trams and trains in Australia. And they're talking about that very thing. That even in Morocco, they told me there's a fast speed train now, and in Australia, you can't seem to get one.
No, and no, and it doesn't sound like it will. Joe, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for being so open about not just the manufacturing sector, but also what it takes to grow a business
Thank you.
and all your points, such as, the skills shortages, but also your positive ones, like, increasing investment. So I think, we small businesses need to band together and come and provide some solutions.
Yeah,
I really
that's for
wish
sure.
you and your company all the best over this period, over this
Thank
Christmas
you.
and holiday period, and may 2025 be another stellar year for
Right,
you and your team.
Thank you, Deanna. I appreciate that.